This is the Family Room Podcast, where I, Peter Squires, get to know your friends and neighbors. My family, they never knew. My family, they never knew.
My family. Welcome to the Family Room Podcast, getting to know your friends and neighbors. I'm Peter Squires. On this episode, my guest is John McLean, also known by many as the Juan McLean of DFA Records fame. John and I discussed dual identities, the contrasting lifestyles of New York City and the New Hampshire Maine seacoast, online dating, depression, addiction, new beginnings, and Kiss, the band, among other things. Enjoy.
It didn't work with GarageBand anymore.
Like it wasn't seeing it?
Yeah, it's like their software updates didn't like recognize when Apple upgraded their latest operating system. So Apple just stopped recognizing the thing, and they weren't keeping up with it. So then I got this little thing, and it like totally works great. But it's
I've heard horror stories of people upgrading the latest operating system.
Yeah.
For the, what's it called? I don't remember what it's called. It has a funny name.
I'm going to look now.
It's the newest one.
Yeah. It's.
But with audio stuff, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It just stopped working.
Yosemite? Or is there a newer
one? No, there's a newer one that just came out. But Yosemite is bad. I did that one in half my, I spent days and days in my studio trying to get it all to work.
Yeah. How did you, because the only answer I could find was that you actually have to like downgrade your operating system. And
yeah.
I was like, well, I don't
know. That's what people were doing. Yeah, there are really elaborate ways of doing that. I don't know. It was on my laptop, so it wasn't really that important.
Yeah.
Because I don't really do a lot of stuff on that. I mean, I have a computer in my studio, big computer. But that's still like 4 operating systems old.
Yeah.
I just won't change it.
Yeah.
Never change it.
I remember in college I had just one of those iMacs, you know, the like
the colored ones.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I love.
And
those
they had free Pro Tools back then.
Oh wow!
It was like
it
was like
LE
8 tracks
or
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could download it for free. Anybody could. And I had free Pro Tools on there, and there was part of me that was like, maybe I should just never get rid of this computer.
Yeah.
Like I can just like, because for a while there was a gap between that time and GarageBand time.
Right.
You know, where like, oh shit, I used to be able to record and now I can't. And now it's like, oh, well, anybody can.
I always say with all that stuff, like, you know, and I have so much money invested in software, like music software, but I do the bare minimum because I'm like, every time they put out something new, like, does it really make you make better music?
Right.
No.
Yeah.
It's like just the same. It doesn't make you make better music. The thing that we had 10 years ago is fine.
Totally. You know? And like, there's these funny little features that you would think would be included. I don't know. I mean, I use GarageBand because it's free. And
yeah.
I'm sure you're using more complicated stuff, but like, you know, like Pro Tools, you can crossfade.
Right.
Like if you mix, you know, if you cut two things together and you want to make them sound seamless, then you can crossfade it. And on GarageBand, you can't. It's like, why not? You know, like, I know you know how. Are they just, like,
saving it
for a later version?
Because they want you to use Logic.
Oh.
That's Apple's. That's what I use.
Got it.
And it's not that much money. It used to cost $1,000.
Really?
Yeah. And then Apple bought it, and now it's $250.
Oh.
Which is pretty
It's not that bad, but that's,
no.
You know, pretty much all I would need it for is crossfading.
Yeah,
you know,
but like, that's why they don't put that stuff in GarageBand.
Right.
So that you have to.
That makes sense.
Buy it.
Well, joke's on them because I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah. Yeah. You should write them an email.
Yeah. Hey, jerks. So do you want me to call you John or Juan?
Yeah, yeah.
John.
John, yeah.
And
when I'm here.
When you're here.
In this area, everyone calls me John. It's a very strange existence, really.
So how does that feel, like, to have two identities that are very, very similar, but, like, or two names that are very similar, but two identities that are very different?
It's, I didn't used to think about it very much until recently, because it's been going on for so long. It's been going on for like 10 years now, probably. 2002. No, more than that. Like 13 years of this existence of like being home, and I'm known just as John.
Yeah.
And then leaving home, and people think my name is Juan. They think that's literally my name, and that's what I respond to.
Right.
And then even like some of my best friends, like in New York, who knew me before the Juan McClain, don't respond to the name John. They'll if someone is like, "Hey, do you know where John is?" They'll be like, "I don't know.
John
There's
who?
No John. Who? Yeah. There's no John here." Yeah. It's weird. It's very strange.
Do you ever wish you'd come up with a different like stage name?
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. And I didn't even come up with it. That's the thing.
Who did?
And my friend James Murphy. Do you know the LCD sound system, James? We were in the studio and I was trying to think of a name. Yeah, it just came up because I was ripping off this kind of legendary techno guy, Juan Atkins, who was like an early, you know, maybe created this kind of music. And then our other friend came in and said, like, "Oh, who do you think you are? Juan McClain?" You know, and then James was like, "That's going to be your name."
And then you were like, "The Juan."
Yeah. McClain. And then he's like, "But I have a great idea. To make it seem more important, we'll put a 'the' in front of it."
It worked. It worked.
Yeah.
It's funny. I, before I moved here, I had heard of you, but I didn't know. So I worked at InSound.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to, or I interned there, and we used to have to go over to DFA to pick up the records
because
they were it was like only a few blocks away. So rather than having them shipped, they would just send the interns over with like a hand truck.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, and then, but so I would see the Juan McClain albums, but I thought it was a band. Like I wasn't familiar with your music, but I was familiar with your name. And then when I moved here, and I think Seth was, or I saw something on Facebook, and your Facebook is Juan McClain. And so I was like, "Oh, that's funny that there's a band called that."
Yeah.
Like this guy has the same name as a band. Yeah. And then sort of like realized that after talking to you a couple times, like, "Oh, this is that guy."
Yeah. It's a weird, there's not very much crossover like with the two worlds.
Yeah.
There's very little like people here. Like my good friends here, that just doesn't register with them at all, you know. And but it is weird. It's done. It's starting to kind of weigh on me. This kind of like, it occurred to me like, I basically have two identities, which was funny for a while, but now, I don't know. I think I've been trying to reconcile it.
Huh.
Really, like, what does this mean? Like, how did I end up with another name? You know,
like, I had this, so I moved to the area, or I was introduced to the area because I used to work out on Star Island out in the Isles of Shoals.
Right, yeah.
And ever since I was a little kid there, everyone called me Turtle. It was just like my star.
I heard this story last
year. Yeah, so, and it was just, I had to like make the conscious decision to stop.
Yeah.
And like to never introduce myself as Turtle, not because I hated the nickname, just because it was like, but I want people to know my name. I want them to know that I have a name. And, you know, if some of them call me a nickname or some of them know me as this other thing, then that's okay.
Yeah.
It just didn't, you know, but it starts to affect you.
Yeah.
You know, having to call yourself different things to different people.
Yeah.
I had a girlfriend who like wouldn't call me anything.
That's what I was about to say.
Really?
The very strange, I feel like that's really where it becomes the weirdest and the most pressing, like you have to deal with it, is if you meet someone and they know you as this other name.
Yeah.
And you're like, actually, it's kind of weird for you to call me this name. If
that's because it's not my name.
Where,
does she call you baby? Mine always just called me baby.
Yeah, but, you know, that comes later, I guess.
Oh, okay.
It's like, you can't, like, really on the first date be like,
you know. So I'm going to call you baby. So, like, what are the, what's the, I want to get into this sort of conflict between the identities, but to kind of get to know each one individually first. So tell me the story of John McClane, and then we'll meet Juan McClane.
Like the whole story?
Yeah. Where does it begin?
Yeah. I was, where was I born?
Sure.
I was born in Dorchester, Massachusetts, which I don't think it was ever a nice place. Maybe, but in, and then my family moved around a lot, like mainly, you know, south of Boston, South Shore, that kind of thing. And then mysteriously, when I was in sixth grade, I think, we moved to Winslow, Maine, which is right next to Waterville, Maine.
Okay.
Which is kind of in the middle of Maine. And I mean, I'm 47. So this was probably like 1978. And it was pretty shocking.
Huh. It was like, so what were the differences between, like, you know, south of Boston life and central Maine life?
Well, I was, my appearance, me and my friends were really into Kiss. We grew in the Kiss Army. It was the 70s and we were like 10 years old. You know, that's their target audience. Like,
well, you know, I'm picturing boy. You right now with the, which, well, who were you? Which one?
I mean, Paul Stanley was always my favorite.
But, I can see that.
You know, and so I show up in Winslow, Maine, which was very, you know, there's no internet back then. Mm-hmm. It was very isolated. And, you know, I had like, I was probably wearing like hush puppies, uh-huh. kind of like flared Wrangler jeans. But my pride and joy was I had a huge glitter Kiss belt buckle and a big white belt. I had really long hair. I just remember the first day of school. My family had moved a lot. So I knew this routine that I knew when recess came, I was going to be in a fight. It was like, it took like 30 seconds, you know?
Did like, you feel like you're like, I have to defend this. I've cultivated this persona and I need to defend it. Or are you just like, oh shit, here it comes.
No, I was just like, this isn't going to work. Cause I just remember them. I really remember like a group of kids surrounding me and one saying something like, what is Kiss? That sounds gay. Yeah.
So how did you explain it? What is Kiss?
Yeah, I don't think it got that far.
As soon as you opened your mouth.
Yeah.
Sucking the kisser.
But then I went to high school back in Massachusetts, in Danvers, which isn't too far from here.
So how long were you in Waterville and how did it play
out? I thought it was 1.5 years.
Uh-huh.
And then when I just saw my mother the other day, she told me it was 4 years.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which I think I had minimized the time because I was so traumatized by being there. Wow.
I wonder if you really did. Like, if you kind of, like, not blacked it out, but you
No,
were
I
just,
did.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
just, like, shoved it into the deepest recess.
Yeah, I just, and I always referenced it as a place that we were at for 1.5 years.
Huh.
Because I was so unhappy there. I did, my uncle started giving me guns because he was really into guns. And I would just go out into the woods and kill everything that moved.
Wow.
I was so angry.
Wow.
I was such an angry kid.
So doesn't that like that? I feel like that resonates right now with the like angry kids with
oh,
guns.
Yeah.
Like it's a good thing that you yeah, had the woods yeah. to shoot at.
That's dangerous territory there. I guess.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, that shit is real.
Well, it was only in retrospect because the angry part, I guess, because that's kind of what kids there did anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, like go outside and shoot squirrels or something.
Which, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, then I went to high school back in Massachusetts, and I felt like the world had moved on, and I had a lot of catching up to do.
Huh. But. Huh. So what caused your family to do all that moving back and forth?
It's still a little unclear to me. My father just kept getting different jobs, I guess, all around, but it was terrible. Like, I feel like it was a really defining thing for me, because I was a really shy kid, and back then, like, now when new kids arrive at a school, like they name the school after the kid for the day, you know, and you get a buddy.
Right.
And all the teachers are really nice. And kids are much nicer in school now than when we were in school.
That's interesting.
Like, you know, I feel like in the last 5 years, like school culture has changed pretty dramatically.
I wonder, I mean, it makes sense to think about, you know, I mean, when you think of all the sort of public rhetoric about bullying and about acceptance and stuff like that. But, like, I wonder what the specific, like, policy differences were that changed that culture.
Well, I think you're right. I think the bullying thing was a big part. I think the kind of, like, gay rights movement moved... It started something that at least, you know, it's like sort of cool to be into gay rights in school. I say this because I have two kids, you know, I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son. So, and my daughter's very politically correct about like, you know, if I'll refer to one of my friends, gay friends, is use the word gay or something, she'll get upset and say, like, why do you have to define what they are, their sexuality or something? And I was like, I didn't even know what a gay person was until I went to college, I think. You know,
you just knew that that's what your Kiss belt buckle
was. Yeah, exactly. I just knew it was this weird thing that people would say. It was a term of some meant to be derogatory or something. Right. But now in schools, all that culture has changed pretty dramatically. I mean, I'm sure kids still pick on kids and all that kind of stuff. But my son, I don't know if this is right to say, but my son got suspended from school for writing the word penis on a computer in the computer lab, which thought was hilarious. Yeah, just to make his friend laugh. And the principal explained to me, you know, he's like, apologizing, you know, he's like, look, I know it seems ridiculous, but it fell under some policy of like sexual harassment or something.
Yeah, like depending on who sees this, they could be traumatized or feel violated.
Yeah. So that's how schools are now.
Wow. Well, and it's like hard to say it should be one way or should be the other, or like that it's right or wrong. It's just decidedly different, you know?
Yeah, and my point was, when I was a kid, you know, like I would show up at a new school and you just kind of showed up and they were like, here's your home room. And then you walk into this room and maybe the teacher told you where to sit.
Right.
But you didn't know anything.
Yeah.
You
know? And socially you're left to your own.
Oh yeah. You're left. Yeah. And if you're just a shy, I mean, imagine being, you know, 12 years old and you walk into the lunchroom and you're just standing there like looking around where to sit. And you can't even sit alone. You know, you have to go sit with some group of people. Like, you know.
Which of these tables is least likely to shun me publicly in front of everyone else?
Basically, it was horrifying for me. I hated it. I wasn't a kid that was going to walk up to a group of kids and say, you know, hi, my name's John. Like, what's your name?
Want to be friends? You know? Yeah. So how did that play out between, you know, moving back to Massachusetts and being a new kid at the beginning of high school from then until, I don't know, coming into yourself? Like, how did that process happen?
Well, it was the summer before I was going to high school, and I had taken a test to get into a Catholic school because my family was very Catholic, and St. John's in Danvers. And I got into the school, and I remember sitting at the my parents' kitchen table, because I had gotten the like information packet from the school, and I was looking through it, and I remember saying to my mother, like, why don't they have any girls in the picture? And it was an all-boys school. No one had told me that.
Yeah.
And now...
But you only figured that out after you got in?
It was like weeks before I was meant to go there. And actually, I was very relieved.
Hmm.
It was kind of, I think it saved me a lot of grief in high school.
I've heard that said frequently about like all girls colleges.
Yeah.
All girls, all female colleges. Yeah. That just removes, it gives you one less thing to be anxious about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's how it was for me.
Yeah.
I was terrified of girls.
Yeah.
Like, especially when you're moving around all the time, and I feel like there's a process where kids, as they start, whatever dating culture means, you know, when you're in high school or something.
Yeah.
Usually, it's like kids that you've grown up with.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, it was thrown into this whole world of like, I didn't know anybody. So it just made it terrifying for me. But I was actually really happy not to have to deal with it.
So then what was school like compared to, I don't know, what you imagine other schools might have been like?
It was a big sports school, my high school. I think it was like one of the number one hockey high schools in the country. That was my thing. I was like, I thought I was going to be like a professional hockey player.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But when I got to high school, it was pretty clear that I was too small. So I kind of gave up on it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, when you say you thought you were going to.
Yeah, yeah. Like, this one, I was like 5 years old or something.
Okay. It wasn't like in high school you were like, I have reason to believe that I'm going to be a professional hockey player.
No, but my high school, Bobby Carpenter, who went on to play professional hockey, was the first, he went to my high school. He was the first high school student to ever be on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you know
him? No, he had graduated the year before I got there. So, but it was a very serious hockey high school. And all the sports were, you know, they're really intense.
Wow.
So I ran track, which all three seasons, like cross country, winter track, and spring track. I really liked it because it's, you know, it's very individual kind of thing.
But was that a way for you to kind of find your place in the school or find a niche where you belong?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You start doing that stuff, it kind of solves a lot of those kind of social problems. But I was a really weird case because I had also gotten very much into punk rock somewhere along the way. So I was really into music and track, which was an odd combination.
Yeah. I definitely found, because I was really into sports, not, you know, playing sports a little bit, but I was just never very good. Like, I was good at Little League until the other kids started pitching.
Yeah.
Like, when the parents pitched, I was like, you know, cranking bombs. But when the other kids started pitching, it was quickly revealed that I wasn't good anymore. But I loved, like, following sports and watching sports.
Yeah.
But then in high school, when I started getting into music, it definitely felt like, oh, I have chosen a new path instead of sports. And it wasn't until pretty much like the very end of college that I kind of figured out that I could like both.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I think that's pretty common because of the sort of social archetypes that go with sports and music.
Yeah, being involved in music scenes, it's like they're pretty anti-sports.
Yeah.
In a way. I don't know if that's still true. I don't know if they even have music scenes anymore. But.
Well, and also in the era of kids being nicer to each other, like, does the archetype of the jock bully still exist?
I don't know, actually. I don't think so. I feel like the lines have been blurred in many different ways.
That's interesting.
Like, at that time for me, when I was in high school, like, you could define yourself by what kind of music you liked.
Right.
And now I don't think that's possible anymore.
Hmm.
Like, I think just with the accessibility of all different kinds of music, like, kids are just into weird, you know, things. You know, my daughter did some presentation at school using like the Smiths and Joy Division or something, but then I had to take her to the One Direction concert.
Oh, wow. You know, like, and she likes them both.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Huh. Maybe it's just they have access to so much more than we had.
Yeah.
That if you can sort of taste it all and spend exactly the right amount of time you want to with any of these sort of categories, then you don't get overly attached to any of them.
Yeah. I see this, of course, sounds like the older generation saying it's not as good as it used to be.
Right.
But I really liked that attachment and that kind of single-mindedness
totally.
And focus. And I was thinking the other day, like, how much things like computers and my iPhone have worn away my memory.
Hmm.
I don't remember things anymore.
Right.
And that when I was younger, like with bands, I would know the names of entire lineups of many different bands.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I could tell you the name of the guy that played drums in some weird band that put out one record.
Totally. And, yeah, I was in high school and into college, I was kind of fanatic about the band Weezer.
Yeah.
And I had like very strong feelings about the direction that the band took when one bassist left and another bassist took over, because right. the original bassist sang the high harmonies, and that's what gave the band their like quirk,
yeah.
you know, and without that, they were just, you know, a shitty, straightforward, formulaic rock band.
Yeah. And now it's,
I have no fucking idea who plays in my band.
Yeah, I don't know anything.
Who plays in my band, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... Yeah. I guess it was... There was so much, like, I guess nerding out about something.
Yeah.
It was just, like, how do you want to devote yourself? You know, or what do you want to devote yourself to and, like, attach yourself to?
Yeah. You know? I think it's, like, the same thing as with music software, where... The more options that become available, the longer it takes me to complete songs. Hmm. And I think back then, because there were so fewer options, because limitations were in place, it made you more focused
yeah.
or something. I think the more options you have, things just become more confused and convoluted.
Totally.
But it's presented these days as, like, isn't it a great world because you have the world of music at your fingertips, basically. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing.
No. Well, and I think that it's, I've heard that sort of, that phenomena applied to romance, that like it's causing yeah. people to not, or even just like happiness. Like
yeah.
they, people are unsatisfied for longer because in the sort of like online dating culture, you feel like you have endless options rather than just like meeting someone you like and sticking to it, you
yeah.
know, and with everything, with jobs, with just options abound, and you know, that it's not necessarily good for us to not have sort of a like solid relationship with contentment.
Yeah. And I feel like Tinder is the ultimate example of that, of like you're scanning through headshots of people. It's like shopping for people.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it puts, I'm actually very fascinated by this whole relationship dynamic now with the internet. And it's basically like the commodification of people. And you, I think people always, there's always the idea that there could be something better.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get into a relationship with someone, and it's not the greatest thing that you thought it was in the beginning, and it starts becoming work or something, it's, you just know there's a world yeah. of people no. who swipe right.
Right. Or you can always just find someone else to have the exciting, fun beginning part with.
Yeah.
You know, that if there's, you know, really that many people available to you, then you never have to kind of hunker down and do the shitty part of relationships that inevitably always arises.
And that's one of the things that makes me happy. I don't live in New York
hmm.
because that seems like a nightmare there.
Yeah. That's a whole lot of fish.
Yeah. And here your options are definitely limited.
I bet. So are you single?
No, I have a relatively new girlfriend.
How's that?
It's amazing, but we have this, I don't know if she'd get mad at me for saying this, but we have the unfortunate thing hanging over our heads that we actually met on Tinder.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think that that's uncommon these days.
No, it's not. But I find it really embarrassing for some reason.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's so prevalent that...
Like, yeah, yeah.
It'll,
it is.
It's one of those things that, like, it might... I don't know. My cousin, I remember... met his wife on Match.com, and they
right.
were embarrassed about that. And now yeah. it's like, now that's like, oh, that sounds wholesome.
Yeah, that's you know? Right. yeah. In the hierarchy of stuff, that's very wholesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the whole, maybe it's millennials that are referred to as the hookup generation.
Hmm.
And that stuff always really bummed me out, actually. I always felt very ill-equipped to navigate that world, which I actually think goes back to the days of my family moving all the time.
How come?
Because socially, I think I never, like I said, like when people are starting to like girls,
mm-hmm.
it was girls that like they had kind of grown up with or something. Mm. And there was already a familiarity. But when you're 12 years old and you like some girl and you're the new kid, you know, I just never learned to do it. I just never wanted to do it.
So does the hookup generation imply that they don't even seek relationships as the ultimate goal?
Right. It's, there's always something else. So why
even aim for
that? Waste your time, you know, getting into something.
Huh. Yeah, I guess that's kind of, well, the one thing though is, I don't know where the sort of generational cutoff is.
Yeah.
But we haven't like necessarily seen millennials turn 30 yet.
Right.
Have we? So like,
I don't think so.
Or what I think of as millennials is there's this sort of...
No, they're still early 20s, I think.
Yeah, so maybe they will... You know, everyone's the hookup generation when they're in their teens and 20s, you know? So maybe they will... That generational priorities will shift just sort of by nature.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it just seems like the same place that we're at with music. Hmm. You know, like you spend... It's always very frustrating to me to spend so much time and effort and, you know, and money making an album. And then it comes out and for a very short period of time, like it's a big deal. And then you just totally disappear.
Totally.
And people move on.
And if you're really, really lucky, then one song from that album lingers.
Yeah,
a little longer.
Right. You just need you need one song basically. But you know, people in that industry will tell you you can't expect anything more than that, like that people's attention spans are so short, they're just moving on to the next thing all the time. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but it seems like it when you're spending time on the internet like looking for coverage of your album that just came out or something.
Right. Exactly.
And if it came out 6 months ago, like that's old news.
Totally.
But that's, it seems like a lot of things are like dating. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I definitely think of myself as an album person. I still, when I make music, I think in terms of, you know, side A and side B even.
Yeah, I do too.
But when I'm looking for new music, I definitely only listen to the first few seconds of something. Or,
really?
You know, I'll listen to a few seconds at the beginning, and then I'll sort of skip ahead to the middle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will not spend a lot of time with something if it hasn't passed the sort of first few seconds test.
Yeah.
But I don't think of myself as being that kind of person. But in truth, like, I definitely do that. Say I want to like get into a new band and I'm sort of checking out which album if I want to get one album of theirs, I'm deciding which one, then I'll just sort of like, you know, iTunes even has the, like, this song is the most popular on this album.
Right.
So I'll listen to that one first. And it's like, yeah, I definitely do that because the tools are all in place for you to browse, to perpetually browse rather than taking a chance based on the album art or a recommendation from somebody and then just either liking it or not liking it at first and then having it grow on you or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. I miss the days of buying records.
Yeah.
And then going home and listening to the entire record.
Yeah.
For some reason it just never occurred to me to like pick the needle up off the record and skip over a song.
Oh no. I mean, and that's such a difference in the actual physical medium.
Yeah.
You know,
but you could.
Yeah.
You could do it.
Yeah.
But no one ever did it.
I think it was just, it's these tiny sort of psychological and in some ways physical, but just like very small obstacles, you know, where it wasn't easy to skip to your favorite song. And like the side of a record was only, I don't know what, 15 minutes long or something like that.
Yeah.
So you could, it was easy to put the needle down on the outside of the record and then just see what happens. Whereas, and then with tapes, it was kind of, in a way, even better because it was like there was not really a skip function.
Right.
And then the CDs just changed it.
Yeah. That is true. CDs, you could just skip track to track. Yeah. But I still make records, you know, yeah. Vinyl records. I mean, to me, it's the kind of like gold standard of music.
Yeah. Well, and that's definitely come back too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's actually hard to get records pressed right now.
I'm trying to do one right now. I just recorded, two songs with Steve Albini. Which is like the greatest thing that's ever happened. And it's like, well, what do you do with two songs? You make a 7-inch, you know, make a 45.
Yeah.
And man, it is not easy to make a 45. And, you know, I don't have a label. I'm not like, I don't have a big following. So it's like all that really makes sense for me to press is maybe 300 records.
Yeah.
And if I did any less than that, then they would, you know, cost $10 each or whatever.
Right.
You know?
I think 300 is the minimum now anyway, pretty
much.
Yeah,
most places. Yeah. And so that's what I'm going to do. And if I sell them all, then I'll pretty much break even.
Yeah.
You know, but I still want that. I still want that as the outcome.
Yeah. And it seems so weird to me to make something and not have a physical copy.
Yeah.
Neil Young said something recently about how people that are doing that, you know, in 20 years, there'll just be there could very well be no document of your music. Like it just simply never existed. Like, we don't know if, well, even now, like MP3s are going by the wayside. There's just no, I don't think anyone's buying MP3s anymore.
That's
iTunes.
So interesting. I didn't even think about that. Like, that just the music is all stored somewhere else.
Yeah.
Or it's just streaming from the cloud or whatever.
Right.
So you don't have to even own anything.
No. And we don't know if, I mean, I'm assuming that these formats won't exist in 20 years.
Yeah. It makes total sense.
You know? Yeah. So then there could be a whole generation of music that's just totally undocumented.
Well, when you think about like the advent of the iPod and like, the idea that we used to carry around a Discman and choose the like 5 CDs that we wanted to bring with us on our trip. And then the iPod came out, and I remember saying out loud to people, like, why would I possibly need to have that many albums all at once?
That's what I thought. Yeah.
But, and now that everything's digital, having MP3s on a device takes up quote unquote space.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's all that's left to do is to have nothing take up any space.
Yeah. I think the new iTunes that just came out, people with big MP3 libraries can't use it. I think because it only uses the cloud, maybe.
Wow.
I should find out. But I know people are complaining that people with really big iTunes libraries, it's not working anymore. Because they have their new streaming service.
Yeah.
So they're going to move everyone away from MP3s.
I still like, I mean, it sounds, it's like weirdly sounds old fashioned. I still like the process of choosing which music is on my phone.
Yeah.
Like which albums I want to have. And it's like, you know, every couple of weeks I'll sort of go through and be like, oh, I'm not really listening to that one. Or, oh, I wished I had that song in my head and I wished I had it on my phone. And it's, you know, it's like an old timey mentality with a new technology.
I use Spotify.
You do?
I mostly listen to music through Spotify.
I think that most people do.
Yeah.
I don't
in my car. Reason. I mean, I have records at home, so
yeah.
But it's funny, I'll go in my car and just listen to some record from the 70s that I have on vinyl at home. Yeah.
And they just have everything, right?
Everything. Yeah.
I should probably get it.
Yeah.
I'm such a slave to like my rituals.
Yeah.
So how did you, you know, you ran track in high school and you sort of spanned the worlds of athlete and, you know, you were starting to get into music. Where did you go, sort of physically and psychologically after high school?
Well, I didn't want to go to college after high school. So I was just done with school. And my parents were bent on me going to college. Like, I think it doesn't occur to you at that age that you don't have to do what your parents tell you anymore. You know, it's like you're 18. But, you know, I was going to be the first one in my family to go to college. So I got into some good schools and chose Providence College, mainly because I liked Providence.
Yeah.
And it was like, gets me out of like the Boston area.
Yeah.
But it's not so far away. I don't know if I put that much thought into it. And then I went there, and then, first thing, just started spending most of my time trying to play in a band, which, you know,
How did it, what was your instrument?
Guitar. When I was graduating from, it goes back, when I was very young, I was probably like 8 or 9 years old, I got an acoustic guitar and took guitar lessons from a woman who sang at our church. They would have like folk masses, and then I would go and play with her at the church, like Michael, Row Your Boat Ashore, mm-hmm. Kumbaya, all those songs.
Yeah.
That's how I learned to play guitar.
Nice.
Yeah.
So then did you put the band together?
Yeah, and then when I was, so I always had an acoustic guitar, and then when I was graduated from high school, I took all the money that I got, like, you know, you get money from relatives
graduation
and all that kind
money,
of thing.
Yeah.
And I was going to buy a motorcycle for my neighbor. And I walked over there and he started getting into this story. It seems like he didn't have the title and like he,
yeah, I just found it didn't somewhere.
Seem very, and then, so I didn't buy it from him. And then I went and bought an electric guitar instead.
What kind?
That I always wanted. It was this weird Gibson that looked like a Les Paul, but it was like a solid block of wood. I don't remember what it was called.
Did it have a flying V head?
No. I don't know, actually.
I had one from the early 80s called an S1.
And yeah, it wasn't that.
It was a Les Paul body with three single coil pickups and a flying V head.
Yeah.
And I thought it was like...
It's like the leftover parts at the
exactly.
Gibson factory.
Yeah. It's just like some weird random bastard.
Yeah. No, the great thing about guitar, though, is you just teach yourself to play it.
Totally.
You know, I never took lessons or anything. So.
Yeah.
And it's a very, I think it's a very social instrument, too, because you get together with your friends and, like, you know, people that have been playing longer than you show you how to play things.
Yeah.
So that's what, I mean, that's mostly what college was for me.
So what kind of music were you making?
And I was really into, like, when I was in high school, into hardcore and the whole Boston hardcore scene and going to, like, matinee hardcore shows on the weekend. And then graduated to like post-punk stuff and discovered like Gang of Four and Public Image Limited. And even I was just remembering with my friend that when we were in high school, I saw like New Order, The Smiths, The Cure in like 1985.
That's
REM
awesome.
In the very early days.
Where did you
amazing.
See them? At like big venues or?
No, like REM we saw at a little theater in Providence. But I was still in high school then, and it probably held like 1,000 people or something.
Yeah.
And remember we saw New Order at the Orpheum in Boston, which I have memories of being very big, but I don't think it's very big.
I don't know how many it holds.
It's not that big, but I saw like Echo and the Bunnymen.
Wow.
There. Yeah, The Cure, The Smiths. But just, yeah, amazing shows.
That's cool.
Yeah, I just got into like sort of post-punk kind of stuff. But the Mission to Burma, who were always my all-time favorite band.
Did you see them when they were in Portsmouth a couple months ago?
Oh yeah, yeah, we're friends. It seems weird to me now, but I somehow, well, actually, I met Clint Conley in probably 1990. I think
wow.
My band, Six Finger Satellite, my first band, were playing at TT the Bears in Cambridge. And, I mean, I was really young.
Yeah.
I was probably like 20 years old or something. And he had come to see the show. And I remember walking outside, and out on the sidewalk, he was talking to my parents because they would always come to the shows. My sister just reminded me that, like, they would always wear black, like all black, because they wanted to fit in or something. But they were really good about it. Like they'd always so come cool. to the shows. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, yeah. And I just remember walking outside, and he was, you know, maybe closer to my parents' age than my age.
Yeah.
And I just remember them having like what seemed like an adult conversation, you know. Me walking up, I think I was really drunk and on a lot of drugs or something.
Mom.
Yeah, I was just like, do you even know who this is? You know? But now, you know, now we're friends. So, and it seems really weird.
And you've known each other ever since?
Yeah, like on and off. But we, it's just so odd to me because another friend of mine, John Fine, wrote a book called Your Band Sucks about being in an indie rock band in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I went to Cambridge to a book reading event that he's doing. And Clint Conley was like the guest. And they did their talk and everything. And I had Clint sign my book. And he wrote something like, thanks, you're always so nice to me. You know, I was like, this guy is like my hero. You know, and,
yeah.
and somehow, I don't know, he has some overly inflated idea of my place in the world. But
well, he knows who you are, and he appreciates that you're nice to him. That's not yeah, overly yeah, inflated. Yeah, that yeah. sounds sweet.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's where I made my first band, Six Finger Satellite. I mean, I basically had two music careers. And sort of both times defied all sense in the music industry, I think. Like with Six Finger Satellite, it was really like, you know, I had bought an electric guitar, I got to college, found the other weirdos that were there that were into the same kind of music I was, and we made a band without, you know, nobody really knew how to play, had ever played with other people. And then a few years later we went to South by Southwest, and John Poneman from Sub Pop Records was there and saw us play. And then we got signed to Sub Pop.
Wow.
I was like, I know. It makes a lot of people mad when I tell that story.
But that's the dream, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what every musician aspires to is
yeah.
someone will be at this gig and someone who we admire or who knows someone we admire who can help us do what we dream of doing will hear us
yeah.
and love us and take us under their wing. And, you know, it happens to a tiny fraction of a percentage
yeah.
of musicians that way, but
you have to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
There's so many things that have to come into play.
Well, you have to be good.
You do have to be good. I have this, still have this kind of, maybe it's a naive notion that whatever good means, if you're making good music, that somehow you won't go unnoticed.
Hmm.
But maybe that's coming from a privileged position of someone who never really had to work that hard to get noticed.
Well, I mean, I think that you do, there's probably a certain amount of trying that you kind of take for granted, that just because you wanted to do it, you know what I mean? Like you were making good music and you were, you know, playing shows or, you know, you went to South by Southwest, you know,
yeah.
you didn't just like stumble toss
oh,
in Texas.
We
like,
used to
intending.
Practice
yeah.
7 nights a week.
Exactly.
We spend all our time like living and breathing music. That's
yeah.
true. Right.
So like, that's not only how you get good, but I think you kind of absorb a certain kind of putting yourself out there that maybe doesn't feel like you're trying that hard to do it just because you've kind of gotten used to doing it.
Yeah. I never thought about that before.
Well, and I think that that's why, you know, you never hear or hardly ever hear stories about people making it quote
yeah.
unquote by mailing their demo tape to somebody and somebody opens the mail and listens to it. Like if you play a zillion shows just because that's what bands do and you want to, and you feel like it, then eventually someone's going to be at the right show.
Yeah.
And it certainly helps if you're at a music festival where like the people in the music industry are. But, you know, if you make a zillion recordings and never go play a show, the odds are much, much smaller that anyone's going to hear the recordings.
Yeah. It's funny because I just gave that same advice to a couple of weeks ago. I've actually been teaching at NYU a little bit.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things I've done recently is advising seniors. They have like a big project they do, graduation project, and advising them. And the reason I'm there is because I'm someone who is doing what they're aspiring to do, basically. And, you know, and of course, everyone wants to get signed.
Right.
And my advice was forget about getting signed. Just play as many shows as you can and just play as much as you can. And you'll meet people who, you know, someone will be signed to a label you want to be on or something. And I think that's the way that it works.
Yeah. That, you know, it's not just the connection of being in the right place, but, you know, knowing, it sounds crass to say knowing the people who can get you into the door, but I don't think it's nearly that business-like. I think it's just, you know, networking is just knowing people and having friends and liking people.
That's like even my label now, DFA, was started as just some friends. We're like, let's just put out this music ourselves. And then every time someone was added to the label, it was a friend, you know, and it's all a collection of, it's more like a social group than it was a record label.
But it was also, I would imagine, friends who legitimately liked each other's work.
Right.
You know, like, I'm sure there was no friend on the label who was just like, oh, let's give Steve a, you know, a whatever.
Yeah.
So how did you get from, so take me through Six Finger Satellite and Sub Pop and what was like the trajectory of that project?
Oh man, that was, those were pretty intense days for me. I had a, the other, while pursuing music when I should have been studying in school, I also developed a pretty bad drug problem as well that went hand in hand with, I mean, by the time we were signed to Sub Pop, I was already a heroin addict.
Wow.
Which was a pretty defining thing at that point in my life.
What year was this around?
I think we signed with them in 92, maybe. Somewhere between 90 and 92. 1990, maybe. And it was pretty intense. I mean, the first, the bass player in Six Finger Satellite died of a heroin overdose, Kurt. And that marked like an end of an era with that band. Actually, what had happened was we were touring a lot, or we were trying to go on tour a lot, and going on tour with two heroin addicts is not fun for the other people in the band.
Yeah,
but there was a lot of, you know, drama of, because every time you got to a new city, like you had to buy drugs. It was not like you could take a day off or something. And we had just so many crazy schemes of having it. Like we would have dealers back home, like send it to us by FedEx and have it held at the FedEx office. And that, at least back then, it would be a federal crime with a mandatory minimum of 10 years if you got caught.
Wow.
So every time we would take turns going to, you know, walk into the door at FedEx and we'd like, you know, like give the other guy your wallet and like all your stuff. Cause you didn't, it was really like, maybe I'm never going to walk out of there.
Wow. And you're even like thinking about that and aware of it at the time and just,
oh yeah,
you're just like, this is a risk that it's, I'm willing to take because I have to.
Yeah. Yeah. It like concerned my, you know, getting busted or even dying were just not concerns at all. And I remember at one point, you know, Jay, the singer in the band, just being like, they were always at the end of their rope with us and being like, you know, we're just afraid that you're going to die. And I remember to make him feel better about it, I said, well, if that happens, just know that that's fine with me. Like, that's just what I want to happen.
Wow.
And thinking that, like, I was saying something really nice. Like, you know, like, oh, this will make him feel
better.
Allow
me to ease your mind. I don't care.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Why should
you? It's like, that's actually what I'm trying to do.
Wow.
And and music was really the only thing that kept me going through that whole time. Like, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do in my entire life.
So with that sort of, like, that pretty sort of spoken out loud awareness that you didn't want to live, basically, or that you were sort of trying to numb this profound pain or escape. Like, what do you think led you to want that?
To annihilate myself, yeah. Basically.
Yeah.
I think it was just a terrible, you know, like perfect storm of a bunch of different things. Like, you know, now that I've learned so much about it, I think genetics has a big thing to do with it. There's a lot of that stuff in my family, mm-hmm. like a lot of addiction in my family. And then, I don't know. I don't want to blame my parents for moving around so much or something, but it really did affect me quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your attachments to people, like I would remember like moving places and just not wanting to say bye to anyone or mm-hmm. moving to the next place and thinking like, well, why bother getting to know anyone? Cause we're just going to leave.
Right.
But you're like, you know, 10 years old thinking this stuff.
Right.
And, I don't know. I now in retrospect, I can see that I was pretty depressed from a young age.
Yeah.
And there really wasn't the vocabulary for that kind of thing back then.
Yeah. I was just thinking that,
you know,
that even the word depressed, I mean, even still telling someone that you go to therapy,
right?
Like I would say 50% of people will in a half joking way say, well, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and it's yeah. like you'd, in some ways it's like become much more common and much
oh, yeah.
less judged. But I mean, it's that sort of stigma still exists. So imagine how much worse it was,
yeah.
you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah. I didn't, it just wasn't on the radar of anything you would consider doing.
Right.
And I think it's just, when you're someone that's in that much, you know, emotional sort of psychological pain, like when you finally do something that just takes it away, it almost becomes impossible to not do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would you, how can you not do it? And that was, became the equation pretty quick.
So how did you not do it?
Well, this went on for, I mean, however many years. At some point we were on tour, Six Finger Satellite was on tour, and we came back and the other guys in the band were just dropping me and Kurt off and just said, well, we're done. Like, we can't do this with you anymore. And that was it. And that for me, I think people are often surprised that like, if I died, it was going to be fine with me, but to not be able to play music anymore was actually the thing that, made me go and like take going into detox seriously.
Wow.
Cause at that, if you took that away, there was, you know, I was like, I'll just kill myself. There was just nothing left in life to live for. It was the only thing I had ever wanted to do in my entire life. And I think the like playing music was doing the same thing that drugs were doing. Like when I was playing music, it was just all that pain and like childhood trauma just disappeared for while you were playing it.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, I still think of it that way. I can think of it as a very like meditative, spiritual kind of experience.
Yeah. Well, and it gives you, especially, I think listening to music can give you this experience, but performing it even more so, that these sort of moments of rush that aren't just like adrenaline and excitement. It's just sort of this profound fulfillment.
Yeah.
You know, like if you hit a moment, especially if you're performing with other people,
yeah,
or in a sort of interactive sort of environment, that moment that everyone sort of recognizes as like, whoa, this was nailed.
Yeah.
It feels so good.
Yeah.
You know, it just,
it's like everything else drops away and you're 100% in the moment of what's happening.
Yeah. So how did you, what was the actual journey from the band breaking up and you recognizing that that was the reason why, and then actually becoming sober?
Well, I had, we had Six Finger Satellite had actually signed a new contract with Sub Pop, and one of the things that we had put in our contract was health insurance, which apparently had never been done before.
Huh.
And I remember there was a news program, like it was the early days of Fox TV.
Yeah.
Like the very early days.
Right.
And this is still, you know, there's like network TV was pretty much, it was the big thing. Cable was still getting off the ground. And they were going to do a feature on it and gave us cameras to take on tour to sort of film what touring life was like. And then I came back from tour and it's so embarrassing. I remember sitting, playing a show somewhere and watching an interview I had done for this news program. And the woman interviewing me was asking me, like, why do you think insurance companies don't want to insure musicians like you? And me saying, well, I think, you know, they think that we're all on a lot of drugs and it's not a very good risk and that kind of thing. But while I was saying this, I was very high, like yeah. nodding off, like visibly nodding off. On the
but
camera.
You were sort of the premise was that you were. That you were not.
Yeah.
Like oh, everyone thinks.
Yeah, everyone
are.
Thinks this. And it's just one of those things of like, I think most people in that deep into addiction at that point are like, you think you're fooling people and it seems comical to people around you that you would think that everyone doesn't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, when we got home, it allowed me to actually go away to a long-term treatment program.
The health insurance?
Yeah, the health. It's the first thing. I think we had the insurance for 2 weeks, and it's the first thing I did with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that's a huge, you know, I mean, when you, you know, being sort of these, like, unintentional revolutionaries by asking for health insurance, like, do you think there was some part of you that knew that that's why you needed it?
Probably, because I knew, because I'd always do, like, in detox a few days. And it just never worked, you know, and I couldn't paying to go away to someplace because you always had to pay was not going to happen either. And I knew there was no way for me to get around it. Like I just couldn't go through the process myself. So, yeah, I'm sure I knew. But, you know, it was a long time. It was like 9 months
wow.
or something that I was away. And, you know, I was assigned Court assigned me a social worker and all that kind of stuff and got me an apartment. I got a job. And even like this was turned out to be a hiatus for Six Finger Satellite. And, you know, yeah, it just took a while for the other guys in the band to see that it was serious.
Mm.
And in that time, the bass player, Kurt, that's when he died of an overdose. Mm. So,
were you aware of that while you were in that? Process.
Yeah, he I had been clean for like not very long. I remember talking to him on the phone and it was one of these things that I had talked with like counselors and my social worker about that I would have to tell him that I couldn't be around him while he was still using drugs. And I told him on the phone and then yeah, and then he died. Like I think the next day, actually.
Oh my God. So, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was really heavy, but I really didn't have any. I was not equipped to deal with that kind of thing back then.
Do you feel like you ever did? Like you kind of ever sort of once you were able to went back and kind of confronted that moment with yourself?
Yeah, it very much came back to haunt me when. Now, you know, I have a band now, like we play live and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And our first drummer, Jerry, who was, you know, pretty much my best friend, I would say at the time, died. Mm. We were in between tours and he was in Brooklyn. He went to, he was going to some kind of benefit. I think it was like to raise money for clothing for kids in India or something. It was in a warehouse in Brooklyn. It was in like a service elevator and it got stuck between floors and he went to jump out onto the floor and actually fell back into the elevator shaft.
Oh
and died. Yeah, it was, I mean, that's still is something that, you know, is a heavy thing in my life, I think on a daily basis, pretty much. But that's when it really made me confront, you know, Kurt's death as well.
Yeah.
Cause now, you know, I was much older and, you know, totally clean and had the tools to deal with that kind of thing. Yeah. Whereas before I just totally swept it all under the rug pretty much.
But. It's I have recently had not a similar experience to that, but you know, my mom died 11 years ago and I was, you know, 23 and not really equipped to deal with it emotionally. And I just sort of really hid however I could, you know, even like as she was sick and I was in the house, I was like in the basement,
right?
Like watching TV and on the computer and listening to the radio all at the same time,
yeah.
Just to not have to see anything, you know?
Right.
And then this year, her sister died. And I felt like I had to deal with both.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because now I could.
Right.
You know, and my experience of mourning my aunt was so much more difficult than my mom because I was actually doing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But then it was, but I was actually doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's amazing how those things catch up to you. Like whether you want to deal with them or not, eventually they kind of make you.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a therapist to explain that to me, that now when someone else dies, you're kind of confronted with the thing you didn't deal with before all over again. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So how did you, when, after Kurt died and you were, you know, becoming clean and sort of learning how to exist in a healthier way and, you know, in a sense sort of be alive anew, like what was the process like from that until sort of feeling good? When did you feel good?
It took feeling good took a really long time. I mean, because you realize, for one thing, just getting off that drug is a really heavy thing. I mean, it takes a long, long time to get everything working again. Like, just chemically in your brain, it messes up so much stuff. And then, you know, you finally get to that point, you realize you're kind of right back where you started when you got addicted in the first place, or worse, because now you have these years of, I think especially with that drug, doing, crossing series of lines that you thought you would never cross. Hmm. And, I mean, I spent years dealing with all that stuff, you know, like, just getting over things that I was really haunted by, feeling guilty about, and just basically learning how to live. And I don't know, I think it really took me like 10 years before kind of felt like a human being again.
So what were you doing during that time?
And I was always playing music. I mean, Six Finger Satellite then went on. We got sort of reformed. And back then it's like no one would have known that we broke up, except we weren't on tour for like a year or so.
Yeah.
And you know, that's when we had our biggest successes.
Wow.
And I'll still say that it's really music that kept me going the whole time. It's like having that one thing to live for and something to like pour that kind of energy in and experience playing with other people, that feeling that you're always trying to get with drugs of, you know, just that, those moments of, you know, everything falling away and you just feel really good.
Yeah.
Is something that I just always pursued pretty relentlessly.
So how long did Six Finger Satellite last?
And then I think in 1998, I quit. Yeah. I was kind of at, I think we had made four albums or five I don't remember how many, but I had kind of like reached the end of just in a lot of ways. Like I just couldn't really do it anymore. And I thought that I just didn't want to have anything to do with music anymore. So I very dramatically quit after our last album came out and kind of like screwed over the other guys in the band pretty badly, because we had like months and months of tours booked, and I basically just bailed on it and said, I'm not doing this anymore.
Wow.
And actually we had played at the Elvis Room as one of our last shows, I think.
Oh, wow.
And I was thinking like, I just don't want to ever have anything to do with music again the rest of my life. Like I was so burnt out on it.
Huh? So how did you get there? If you saw it as this literally, you know, life-saving, like the influence that basically kept you alive was the only thing that you sort of wanted to live for. How did you come to that opposite conclusion?
I think those kinds of bands do play themselves out, you know, and I was, you know, we were kind of a antagonistic, band that, you know, we kind of got off on playing like loud, like aggressive shows. And when 30 is approaching, back then I was like, I can't be doing this when I'm 30. Like that's really old and nobody wants to see that. You know, that was my whole thing, which
wow.
That is very much gone out the window these days.
Yeah.
And I just had reached this block where like, I couldn't really write anything anymore. Like I felt like, I was having a hard time coming up with even parts for songs or whatever. And it just felt so bad to be on stage and be like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Hmm.
I don't know. I still don't know if it was the right decision or not.
Well, I mean, clearly you went back to making music.
Yeah,
so
I did.
Did you ever kind of reconcile with the other guys in the band?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I think they held it against me for a long time. Maybe still now. So
wow. And did they continue to make music?
Yeah, they did. It was really weird for me because it was my band that I started, but they did for a little while. But yeah, I went through a period. This is actually when I moved to this area. And I thought of the move from Providence to here, I thought of as it made sense that I had given up making music. Like, I'm just going to go up there. Like, I'd always lived in the city.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to go up there, and they probably don't even have music there. You know what I mean?
How did you even know that this area, like, existed?
Because my now ex-wife... she had gotten pregnant by me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an important part. And you know, we had talked about getting married anyway, and it just very quickly, like, well, let's get married and have this baby. And she grew up in York or Kittery. And, I don't know. I had been here, you know, visiting her parents and stuff, and I really liked the area. I just remember very distinctly, like, when we did move here, the first time I drove, you know, from Providence to, we moved to Kittery at first, and just, like, feeling so much anxiety fall away, just not being in the city anymore.
That's interesting.
Thought it was really nice.
Did you have any kind of residual Maine trauma?
I don't. I think I still do, actually, a little bit. But Portsmouth, I really thought of it as Portsmouth.
Yeah,
like that was the place.
I still kind of do.
Yeah, I do too.
That Portsmouth is the town, and the other towns are kind of satellites. Though Kittery is starting to develop.
Kittery is
its own.
The Brooklyn.
That makes me.
It always makes me laugh.
Makes me cringe,
quite a bit.
Just is like, come on, like.
It also makes me laugh when people say, "Don't talk that way because everyone's going to find out." There's one little block in Kittery that has like some nice restaurants and a coffee shop.
Yeah, you know. And it's great. It's totally great.
Those are the things. I mean, I couldn't survive without those things.
Yeah.
So
then how did you escaped the city and you moved to the country, and
yeah,
you and your wife had a child,
yeah,
and you were in this sort of like calm, nice, easy. My buddy Johnny calls it Easy Town.
Yeah,
I left New York to move to Easy Town. Yeah. You know, and so you're in Easy Town, and you're starting a family, and then how? What became of that, and when did you let music back in?
Well, I had gone back to college because I never finished before, mm-hmm, and gotten my degree, and I thought I was going to go to graduate school, and I was trying to decide between majoring in psychology or being a teacher, mm-hmm, and I ended up teaching at a special needs school up here. It was in Hampton, and they had this like critical shortage provision then, where if you had, say, I had my degree in English, but because I didn't have any teaching credits, I could be supervised by another teacher and do a series of like training things, and while teaching, get certified to teach.
Interesting.
So I did that for a couple years. And when the thing that had happened with not having music in my life anymore is I got very depressed again, mm-hmm, like close to suicidally depressed, and not really knowing why either. Like, yeah, I never really put any of these things together back then. And then I just started, my friend James Murphy had, a friend of ours had bought a building in the West Village in Manhattan, and James was building a studio in the basement, and then there was, you know, a film production company on one floor, and then shortly after, you know, the record label offices on the top floor, what would become DFA Records. Mm. And, but before there was a DFA, you know, I would go visit James in New York all the time. And I went, and he was showing me the studio, and he was working with this other guy, Tim Goldsworthy, who had gotten him into, you know, this new way of like producing music on the computer and music, like electronic music programming and all this kind of thing. And they basically like sent me home with, you know, a little like music production set up, and I just quickly became obsessed with it, and making, you know, that I could do it by myself. And at that point I was doing it with a baby in my lap, like after work. So I would come home from work teaching and be pretty exhausted and have to take care of a baby and sit in front of my little studio, just like making music, that not really even knowing what I was doing.
Right.
And,
well, but that's how you started with the band too, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It was just like, just doing it, yeah, with no one to tell me that I wasn't supposed to be doing what I was doing.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably leads to more kind of genius creative output.
Oh, yeah. I wish I could get that back.
Yeah, without feeling like contained by the limits of what you are and aren't supposed to do.
Yeah, I'd love to get that mentality back. Mm. Because now, you know, back then, I made an entire, my whole first album in the hours after work,
yeah,
like trying not to fall asleep. And now, you know, I can go to my studio and I have all day.
Right.
And I just sit there like, I don't know what to do, you know, because you're just, your head's so filled with like, you know, what you're supposed to do or not do, or what other people are thinking you should do, or that kind of thing. But anyway, I did, you know, this is like 2000, 2001, and at some point I took a couple of songs to New York to work on with James in the studio and finish. We did that, and then we were talking about like labels to put it out with, maybe, and maybe going back to Sub Pop. And and then one day James and I just went for a walk, and he proposed he's starting a label and putting it out, and that's basically how DFA Records started.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was your album the first one?
My record was the second one. Span the Rapture was the first one. And then LCD Sound System was the third one.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so all the while, you're still teaching? Or
yeah, I was teaching. And then it all blew up, like, very quickly. Hmm. And this is kind of pre... I mean, the internet was around, obviously. Right. But it wasn't really, like, you know, a lot of, like, music involvement with the internet. It was still... still records and CDs.
Yeah.
And I remember teaching, like,
That was Napster era.
Yeah, it's when Napster started ruining all that stuff. I remember I would have a record come out, and I'd go to Barnes & Noble and look at the music magazines and, like, read about my record.
Yeah.
And it was very surreal, you know. It's like leaving this little teaching job, like, in New Hampshire, and then going and, like, reading articles in a music magazine about yourself.
Yeah.
And at some point, I got offered a publishing deal that was pretty significant. And it was enough that I would get an advance. And it was like 2 years of my teaching salary.
Yeah.
And I just made the decision to just try to do it full time.
Wow.
Quit my job.
So was there any... I mean, I guess by that point, you had already gotten fully back into it from the creative side. So you just sort of confronted the baggage or the demons or whatever of, like, the decision to leave music behind you. You'd already sort of welcomed it back in.
Yeah, it's weird. I didn't really think of it that way, though. I think because I was doing it all myself.
Hmm.
You know, because you could... It was this way of making... Well, there were two things. It was this production way. You know, I had been an engineer at that point for, like, 15 years or something. I always had my own studio. And this was something I could do on my own. Like, I didn't, you know, being in a band, like a serious band, it's like being married to three people.
Right.
You know, that was what I didn't want to be a part of anymore. That and kind of discovering this new world of music, like electronic music, that it just felt really exciting, you know?
Yeah. Like starting over again.
Yeah. It felt like starting all over again. Like that excitement of, like, asking people, you know, about, like, what's good and then digging into it and learning the vocabulary and all that kind of stuff. It was really fun and exciting.
It's like you got to be in high school again, basically.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. I mean, that's what it felt like for all of us. It was like we were all, like, people with punk rock background getting into this kind of music. Basically, the mentality was, like, we're tired of not having fun, you know, because we all had come from bands that were, like, you know, you couldn't smile or laugh or anything. You had to be serious.
Angry.
Yeah.
We just want to dance.
Yeah. And then it's like, why don't we just have fun?
You know?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And there's something, like, refreshing that it was, like, a very feminine kind of thing.
Hmm.
Whereas, you know, all the bands we had played in were definitely, like, these very stupid, like, masculine, you know, like, you play a show and you look out, you just see a lot of people with their arms folded.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the show, people would be like, you know, that was such an amazing show.
You're like, really? I couldn't tell.
It's like, there's no way of telling, really. Whereas, like, getting into dance music, it's like, it's such a functional thing. And like, having fun is inherent in the whole experience. You know? People don't dance when they're angry. And again, it's such a feminine thing. It's such a more, like, there were more girls at shows than guys.
Yeah.
Which I found very nice. Or just not for, you know, because I wanted to pick up girls or anything, but just, it's just a nicer atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So then as the music career started, as it became your career again, how did it affect your sort of the simple life that you'd adopted?
It blew it out of the water pretty much.
Yeah.
I got divorced, which it had definitely played a part in it. I had a really hard time for a while because I would go off, you know, on tour. I started DJing, which is what kind of funded everything I did and still does, really. It's how I support myself. And I had a live band as well. And I would go out, you know, traveling all over the world doing this stuff and then come home and just feel really isolated.
Hmm.
It still is very difficult for me, actually.
But this kept being home. like this yeah. being.
Oh yeah.
So you do you sort of split time between here and New York, or is it just that you're traveling to make music and perform live, and then this is always home base?
Yeah, I mean, I have my studio here that I can do a lot of work in, but generally I finish music in New York, and then I'm either DJing or playing live. But then I do have to be in New York for a bunch of things. So I mean, I have a room at my friend's apartment in New York, but for a while I was trying to spend as much time there as possible.
Yeah.
And it was actually much more depressing because I had to be here for my kids.
Right.
And then I just made a conscious decision, like I'm going to, you know, have a life here.
Yeah.
And not treat it as another hotel room.
Yeah.
But I find it very difficult here. I still do. It's still, I've lived in this area now for 15 years. And I still, there are situations where I still feel like the new kid, basically. Mm-hmm. Or even if I, regardless of how long I've lived here, I always find it very peculiar here that people, like, social groups seem very solidified. And people seem very entrenched in their identity, like in those groups or something. And it's really weird to me.
Yeah, I've felt that way too, and definitely can relate to that feeling of being a perpetually new kid. And I was actually talking to someone on one of these podcasts who said, "Oh, I thought you'd been here forever."
Yeah,
it's like, well, I thought you'd been here forever, right. And it turns out that. You know, there are people who have been here forever, which is a lot different from, you know, living in New York or, you know, big city places that most people kind of come from somewhere else or people tend to gravitate there from other places.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's like probably half the people here are from here or, you know, have some sort of
at
family
least.
Tie reason to be here. But that means that there's, you know, nearly half the people aren't from here and they all have a story of how they got here and when they met these people and who they're friends with and who they actually like and don't like, you know, there are stories underneath that, but I totally can relate to what you're talking about in terms of seeing that sort of solidified group of friends or group of coworkers or whatever, who just seem to be planted in the ground here.
Yeah. Or there seems, and there always seems to be these kind of hierarchies. Hmm. Like, oh, well, we're the good friends because we grew up here together and have known each other our whole lives. Which always seems very junior high-like to me.
Interesting.
Whereas in other places I'll go, you know, meet someone like in Paris one night. And then, you know, every time I go back there, like we have dinner or something.
Right.
Or being in New York, which is, I think, the most obvious example where everyone's thrown in together and no one's really from there.
Right.
And I just never comes into the equation, like, who's been someplace longer than anyone else or
right.
who's been friends with anyone else longer, that kind of thing.
It is funny how the, like, how long you've been here thing, because I don't think the people who are from here feel superior about it per se.
I just
think that it's part of their knowing of each other is that they've known each other their whole lives.
Right.
And they maybe don't necessarily think about how that feels to people who haven't. I don't know. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just an interesting piece of the dynamic.
Well, I also think, to be fair, this is an area where you, most people here, it seems like, you know, people have families or they're married. There's not a lot of life or lifestyle choices, things to do if you're just like a single guy in your 30s or something and you don't want to hang out in bars.
Right. Yeah.
There's not a lot of options.
It's true. I mean, where do you hang out?
Yeah. Where do I?
Yeah.
I mean, I end up hanging out in like, I mean, going out to dinner endlessly.
Right.
Seems to be the thing to do.
Yeah.
But it is one of the hardest things I or the hardest thing for me living here is I'm 47 and like I, even if, you know, I have a girlfriend, I guess it's not the same as being married, but I still maintain like my friendships with other people. Mm-hmm. And I notice here, it seems a lot of people seem guilty of like they're in a relationship, they're married or something. And it just becomes very easy to be like, well, we don't really have to do anything anymore because we can just stay home and watch Netflix or something. Yeah, so then, you know, like I, you know, my friend that I hang out the most with here, somehow it's always become some joke over the years that we're like a gay couple or something. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, you guys are so cute or something. And yeah. I think it's because it's so odd to people that like two guys would go like out to dinner together or something, or like go, you know, like drive to Portland just to hang out or something. Right. Whereas if you're in like a city, you know, people do that stuff all the time.
It's true. That's interesting. That's really interesting. I definitely noticed when I moved here, I was 29 and, hardly anyone I knew in New York was married yet or had babies. And here everyone I knew was married and had babies or married and about to have babies. And it was there was a big adjustment, the sort of the de facto setting of people in my age group was different.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're totally right that's been a difficult thing for me to adjust to, is like a social life without kind of buddies.
Yeah.
You know, that I have friends and I have groups of friends, but I hardly ever just I don't just go out with, you know, like you're describing, your guy friend or your girlfriend or any other kind of friend, just do you want to go do something right now?
Yeah.
It's much more plan based here. And I think that, you know, because people have houses, they hang out in their house, and in cities, people hang out in the city more.
That's true. I didn't think of that. I mean, there's so many people, my friends, I've never been to their apartment in New York or something.
Right. You know? Yeah. So, I was just in New York for the week for Thanksgiving. I grew up on Long Island and my family's there. And I was hanging out at my buddy's apartment in Williamsburg. And then he had to go to work and I had nowhere to go for the day. And I just didn't know what to do with myself. It was like, well, I don't have my own apartment. And so I could just be out and about in the city. But I ended up driving back to my dad's house because I was like, well, I need a house to hang out at. Because I've gotten used to it, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that previously I would have felt a lot more comfortable just sort of bopping around the city.
Yeah. I mean, I do that there all the time, especially Williamsburg, like just roam around all day. But yeah, I mean, that's also the appeal of a place like this. Like if you want to, it's a really nice place like to settle in, have kids and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what it's made for. That's what it is. Everything is oriented toward that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my problem with it isn't a criticism. It's just
different.
That's just the way it is being who I am living in this place.
Right. Well, and that's why you came here, you know?
Right.
I think that
it is. Yeah.
You probably have held on to that a little bit in terms of, you know, this is why people are here.
Yeah. It is. It's funny seeing it through the eyes of like friends when they visit, like people will come, I'll just be complaining about being isolated here and like, where did everyone go? And you haven't seen these people for months and whatever my complaints are. And then one of my friends will come from New York and just, you know, like marvel at how nice it is, and how laid back it is. And, you know, there's the ocean or you can go hiking. Mm-hmm. And there's like decent restaurants and it's very scenic and charming.
Well, I've spent a ton of time thinking about this.
Yeah, I have too.
That New York and here are kind of yin and yang in terms of the strengths of New York are the weaknesses here and vice versa. You know, like my friend who has this great apartment in Williamsburg that I always stay at whenever I go to Brooklyn, like, you can go out to get a different ethnic cuisine for every meal, and you right. can go to a show or an art gallery or whatever. Yeah. You can see the world 1,000 times a year.
Yeah.
You know, just within a half an hour of your apartment. But he has like an 8 by 8 foot concrete courtyard, and he's like, outdoor space, huh?
Yeah.
Pretty nice. And that's like, well, you know, I don't have all that shit, but I've got a front yard and a backyard.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, so the peace and quiet here is something that no amount of money could buy in New York City.
Yeah.
But you also lose out on all that other great stuff. So
yeah. I don't think there's an answer.
No.
I've been thinking about this ever since I've lived here, basically.
And if there was one place that had all of these things in just the right amount and great weather, yeah. everyone would live there, you yeah. know, but
yeah.
it doesn't.
No, I've gone back and forth with this, especially I've always figured that when my kids, you know, my daughter's 18, I just make a beeline for Williamsburg.
Hmm.
Now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, you'd probably, you know, the grass is always greener, so yeah. having access to both is...
And I always tell people, this area has a lot of the things I want in New York. There's just, like, 2 coffee shops, maybe,
right.
instead of, like, you know, North Williamsburg, where there's 20 in a, you know,
yeah,
8-block radius.
Totally.
But, and there's people that you would find there. There's just not many of them, yeah. you know.
So this yin and yang in lifestyle sort of brings us full circle to the dual identity thing
yeah.
that we started talking about at the beginning. So you're sort of splitting time between places. You're experiencing life as a like a now very well established, well known musician who does it for his living and goes by the Juan McLean, and then you yeah. have, you know, John and Kittery, who, you know, has a best friend who he goes out to dinner with and feels isolated.
Yeah.
Like, how do those, so how are you reconciling those selves?
I try to actively focus on not, it sounds so simple, but just to focus on the positive, and the, because I basically have like a dream life at this point, hmm. you know, for me to get like bogged down in, well, you know, what's the coffee shop, you know, it's not quite like, you know, their espresso. I feel like a single origin espresso would be nice, you know, like those kinds of details. You know, I look at the big picture and it's like, I support myself with a music career, which is incredibly rare and lucky. And, I get to go out in the world, travel the entire world, and then come home to this really scenic setting where I can relax.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I could set it up any better than that.
Yeah.
You know? It's just, yeah, it's a pretty ideal life, really.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it from the outside, but I think that anyone yeah. can, anyone can get hung up on the things they don't have.
Yeah. I'm always very careful who I complain to about this stuff, you know, because I'll be like, you know, like, you know, I can't believe I have to go back to Barcelona. I was just there. Like, I have to be there for 3 days. I just don't want to be there. And then you're telling your friend who has to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go, you know, work in a field.
Right.
You're just like, I just want to punch you in the face right now.
But that, you know, it's having that interaction helps keep you, helps you maintain the perspective that you need to go on appreciating those things.
Yeah. And I think if I lived in New York, I'm not sure I would have made it really, you know, it's like the place of endless distraction.
Yeah.
You know, and there's something about like being creative living here that makes it a lot easier for me to just put my head down and not worry about anything else that's going on. You know, like not being bombarded by influences or something all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really nice.
So you've been making it work as the Juan McLean for 15 years now?
Since my first record came out in 2002, so 13 years. I'm trying to stretch it out as long as possible.
Are you still enjoying it?
think, to you? Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think I like it more as time goes on. But also, I am at an age where I start thinking about, like, I'm not so far from the end, you know? Even when you're in your 30s, it's kind of like, there's no end, you know? Like, everything's just, you just go on living life, you know, forever.
Yeah.
So, I try to be very appreciative that, you know, I've had a music career as long as I have, and it can be taken away at any time. You know, you can just wake up and really the world has moved on and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, like, just tastes change and what's cool changes. And
so now that you have been, I mean, I suppose it's been your living for a while. If that started to happen, say the audiences started to kind of dwindle.
Yeah.
Do you think you would try to keep with the audiences in order to maintain your career, or do you think you would allow it to stop being your living?
I think about this all the time too, because I have a lot of anxiety about this, because I've gotten so used to supporting myself doing the thing. It's just fun. Yeah. You know, like, who gets to do that? You know, it's just like, what is the thing that you love to do more than anything else in the world? And then you're getting paid to do it. And the other thing is that living here allows me to live, like, pretty well. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't make a lot of money, but I make enough that I don't have to worry.
Right.
But if I lived in Williamsburg, I'd have to have 5 roommates,
right.
You know?
Right.
But I think if it really, I get glimpses of things changing, and like when I listen to music that my, you know, with my kids or something, what they're listening to, and I'll get these moments of realization of, like, that music is really beyond it's beyond me. Like, it's not for me.
Right.
And that whole realization of, you know, it's their world. And it could just push me out of the way.
Yeah.
Is scary. But I think I would just drop out completely. It's more interesting to me to just, you know, just go and do something else entirely.
Yeah. What do your kids think of your music and your career?
It's really hard to tell because they've grown up with it. But, you know, my daughter thinks it's cool. You know, on her phone, I realized she has my name as DJ Dad. And her friends, you know, 13-year-old girls or something, they were going to a dance recently, and they were all at my apartment. And I joked, like, okay, I'm going to be coming. Keep an eye on things. And they were like, oh, that would be so cool, you know. So they think it's cool.
That must feel nice.
Yeah, it's good, but it's hard, you know, sometimes it's hard to get taken seriously too, you know.
By them or by other people?
By them. You know? Yeah.
DJ Dad doesn't even like One Direction.
Yeah,
what an
exactly.
idiot.
Yeah.
What an old fogey. Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's really funny. You're living here. Like, sometimes I'll just be walking down the street in Portsmouth and some kid will come up and be like, hey, aren't you Juan McClain? And I'll go, say, yeah. And they'll be like, well, what are you doing here? Are you on vacation or something? And, you know, let's say I live here and they don't believe me.
That's funny.
Yeah. Or I'll play at the Red Door every once in a while, DJ there, and people come and thank me for coming all the way from New York. All the time. I think every time I play there, someone says that.
Wow.
They're like, it's really nice of you to come all the way here from New York. Yeah. So, I don't know.
Huh. That must contribute a little bit to your feeling alienated here, like, come on, I'm one of you.
Don't I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if people have this, like, I've been doing this kind of thing my entire life. So a long time ago, I lost any kind of reference of, like, how I might be perceived. Like, when I was a kid going to shows, if there was a guy in the band, just the local band playing at a show, like, they were like my idols.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't talk to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Like, they were heroes. They were like on another level altogether. And I just lost that a long time ago. So I forget that, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if around here, like, maybe people think I don't want to be bothered with just like normal people or something. You know? And it just never occurs to me. Yeah, I don't think about it at all. Like, it's not how I relate to myself in any way. And, yeah, I don't know. It's just weird. It's just one of those weird things, trying to reconcile being here and going out there, I guess.
Being here and being elsewhere and being different things to different people.
Yeah. Yeah. I it's funny because I end up romanticizing being a very normal person, which is weird. Like, my friends that just have like 9-to-5 Monday through Friday jobs and just do really normal things and have, you know, lived in the same place for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I envy that quite a bit.
Well, you could have it. I'm sure any day that you wanted to, you could probably have it.
I don't know. I've also reached this point where I've realized that, like, when you're younger, you think, well, maybe I could be a doctor or something, or like, you know, those things aren't out of the question. Like, right. I could do anything. Yeah. Just go back to school for a while. And it is something that I wrestle with now, is that except for 3 years of teaching, and I never actually got certified to teach because I didn't do the program long enough. And then, like, manual labor jobs I had when I was younger. Like, I don't have anything. I'm qualified, like, to work at a juice bar. And even then, they're going to say, no, you're too old, you know.
Like, you're going to get arthritic from the
juice squeezing. Or we want some young, like, hot girl working here or something. Like, I don't know what I could ever do.
You're still hot, John.
Yeah.
Hot enough for the juice bar.
Yeah, for the juice bar. Just in Kittery, I guess.
All right. So I'm looking through the lightning round questions, and I feel like you already answered almost all of them. So I'm going to skip to just one.
Good sign.
If you could do one thing every day forever, what would it be?
Masturbate.
John McLean, thank you for being on the Family Room podcast.
Thanks for having me. My family.